This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I felt like death. And I remember actually praying one time that if I was able to go to sleep, that I wouldn't wake up again. Yeah.
This is Nyasha. She and her husband live in Georgia.
So about 2 years ago, my daughter was a year old when my husband and I found out that I was pregnant again. And we were both excited and we wanted to have another child, but I was sick.
Nyasha was having grave difficulty carrying the pregnancy this time around. It threatened her health.
I was severely dehydrated. I couldn't eat or drink. Sometimes I couldn't even sleep.
She could barely get out of bed. Nyasha says that meant that her family's welfare was also at risk.
I was the primary caretaker for my children because my husband works 12 to 16 hour days. And I was sick all the time. And so sometimes I would go to sleep and be angry when I woke up because I would wake up so sick. And my six-year-old son was frustrated because he had to help take care of his younger siblings. And it wasn't fair to him to have this responsibility when he wasn't even old enough to take care of himself.
Every woman who seeks an abortion does so for her own deeply personal reasons. But many, many women are like Nyasha. According to the CDC, almost 60% of patients who seek abortions are women of color. Half live at or below the poverty line, and 60% are already mothers. Mothers like Nyasha. She and her husband have four children. Another child was stillborn. She had a history of complications and high-risk pregnancies.
When I was in labor with my youngest son, my husband and I experienced how my labor pain was downplayed as a Black woman. Before I went into labor, I had vivid dreams of dying in labor. And when I got to the hospital, I was terrified. The reality shook me to the core when the nurses tried to tell me that I was not really in as much pain as I stated. No matter how much I cried or screamed, I even had to beg for an epidural, and it took 2.5 hours for the anesthesiologist to come to me.
Nyasha told us again and again, when they found out she was pregnant, she and her husband wanted the baby. They wanted to welcome another child into their home. But early on in the pregnancy, Nyasha was so debilitated by sickness, she needed help.
I had a home care nurse. She would come to my house and give me IVs and equip me with the Zofran pump that pumped the anti-nausea medication directly into my stomach through a catheter. And I wore it day, I wore it all night. The only time I took it off was to take a shower. Like, I even kept talking to my doctors about it, and they wanted to keep me in the hospital, but we had no family support system. My husband and I are our kids' sole providers, and staying in the hospital for an extended period of time really wasn't an option for me.
Nyasha says she had to make a difficult decision, one which her husband supported.
My only option was to have an abortion, but it was the only decision that I could make because, I didn't have family who could watch my children while I stayed in the hospital.
Before getting an abortion, Georgia requires a patient first receive counseling and then go through a 24-hour wait period. The procedure cannot be performed after the first 20 weeks of pregnancy. Nyasha met the requirements, and a friend drove her to a clinic in Augusta. Women in a similar situation may soon be unable to receive an abortion in Georgia. In 2019, Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill effectively outlawing abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy. A federal judge struck down the law last summer. But now, following the Supreme Court's ruling last week overturning Roe v. Wade, Georgia's Attorney General Chris Carr has asked a federal appeals court to let the Georgia law take effect. Nyasha says that being able to access an abortion saved not only her health, but her family.
And since my abortion, my children are thriving. I have earned my first undergrad degree, and I'm currently continuing my education. I've elevated in my career, and I'm now a social justice organizer and advocate for other women. So needless to say, I couldn't have seen my life without an abortion because I could not have carried my pregnancy to term, and I wouldn't have wanted to live that way. Before, I did not agree with abortion or ever consider it as an option for me. But because I was raised in the church and always told abortion was murder, due to my experience, I now look at abortion through a different lens. Abortion is actually healthcare, and I did what I needed to do to ensure that I was healthy enough to take care of my family. And that's why I wanted to share my story, because of the shame surrounding abortion and the stigma that people have abortions because they don't want a child or another child. And for me, that just wasn't the case at all. So I wanted to shed some light on that.
So what does Nyasha think now about what could happen because Roe v. Wade is gone? She says she's sad, anxious, and fearful for women like her.
Even more so now than I've ever been in my life. I think my anxiety now is on 10 because I don't think people realize what our future is gonna look like.
That's Nyasha, a mother of four, who spoke to us from Georgia. Well, let's turn now to Kwajalein Jackson. She's executive director at the Feminist Women's Health Center in Atlanta and serves on the board of directors of the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. Kwajalein Jackson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me today.
First of all, how familiar does Nyasha's story sound to you?
It sounds incredibly familiar. There are certainly many people who come in seeking care who have very similar circumstances to what was described, where they're already parenting, caring for multiple children, and are concerned about their ability to continue to care for those children while also having a difficult pregnancy.
The Feminist Women's Health Center, if I understand correctly, has been providing abortion care and other services since 1976. Is that right?
That's right. Our center was founded very shortly after the original Roe versus Wade decision.
So tell me then, who were the majority of patients who've been served there since 1976?
So currently, the majority of the patients that we serve are Black people. We certainly serve people who identify as low income or as receiving Medicaid assistance. About 20 to 25% of our patients are non-English speaking. About a third of our patients identify as LGBTQ or gender non-conforming. And again, many of our patients are already parenting. The majority of our patients have other children that they're caring for.
Mm. So, I mean, this is why we wanted to focus this hour on really who is seeking and needing access to safe abortions, because it's a very different picture now than it was in the 1970s when Roe was first decided. I read those statistics earlier about more than at least half are low income, and more than 60% are women of color. So what do you think the impact will be, particularly on these folks, the folks that you serve at the Feminist Women's Health Center, now that Roe is gone?
Well, one thing I'll also offer is that abortion access has been difficult for communities of color, even with Roe fully intact. The challenges that folks have to face to get to care, afford care, and then also navigate the multiple restrictions and barriers that have been put in place by decades of legislation have made it incredibly difficult. And those obstacles are only multiplied by what has transpired from the Supreme Court most recently. For example, in Georgia, 95% of counties did not have a local clinic. And so people inevitably have to travel for care. And the cost of the abortion itself can also be incredibly burdensome. People making decisions about what other bills they might forego in order to make sure that they have sufficient funds to pay for their abortion. Because Georgia decided to block Medicaid recipients from using that coverage to cover their abortion, we offer a Medicaid discount so that people who do qualify for Medicaid coverage will at least have some relief in their ability to afford their care. But all of these compounding factors, in addition to the risks of continuing a pregnancy to term, all of these things, I think, will be exacerbated, multiplied, and will reach sort of dangerous levels as a result of the overturning of Roe.
That 95% of Georgia counties having no clinics that provide abortion. I'm also seeing that more than half of Georgia women live in those very counties. So you're talking about quite a large percentage of people there who have to travel at least some distance to get this kind of care. Kwajalein, we've got about 30 seconds before our first break here. Have you seen people having to travel even further now to get to you at the Feminist Women's Health Center in Atlanta? I'm hearing about you're already seeing patients coming in from out of state.
That's correct. Because Georgia law has not changed in light of the Roe decision yet, but in other neighboring states, it has. States that had trigger bans or pre-Roe bans are deferring their patients to travel to other places for care. And in the Southeast, Georgia is that place.
For now. Yeah, it might change if the federal court allows that 6-week ban to take place. Well, today we're talking about the impact of the overturning of Roe v. Wade, particularly on women of color, many of whom are already mothers, because the majority of women who are seeking abortion are already mothers. So what impact does it have on them and their families? We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today we're talking about what the overturning of Roe v. Wade might mean for the future of women of color, women who live at or below the poverty line, women who are already mothers, because that group of women form the majority of people currently seeking abortion care in this country. I'm joined today by Kwajalein Jackson. She's executive director at the Feminist Women's Health Center. She also serves on the board of directors of the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. She's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. And let me bring in Fatima Goss Graves as well, joining us from Washington. She's president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Fatima, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to talk with both of you more about what we need to understand within that fact that most women, or 60% of women who are seeking abortion care, are already mothers. Because we heard Nyasha, as she told us that story at the beginning of the show, talk about how her difficult decision to seek an abortion was driven by two things, right? The danger that her current pregnancy was posing to her health, but also that she and her husband had no other support to care for their kids. And her family's well-being was very central to that decision. How common is that, Fatima?
It's actually very common. I think when we think about the fact that 59% of people who have abortions are already parents. They're thinking about their children. They're thinking about their ability to support their own families. They're thinking about their ability to do things like travel. As you see more and more people traveling, it's one thing to pick up your own self and travel, and another to figure out how are you going to ensure your other children are okay? What sort of childcare do you need to set up? Do I have an ability to get time off of work? Will I lose my job if I miss a day or two or many days away? You know, the sort of chaos that was ensued in the Dobbs decision is only going to amplify the many, many barriers that were already in place.
So are you saying that you don't think the Dobbs decision recognizes the sort of domino effect it would have on it will have on families?
So the Dobbs decision was striking in that it paid very little attention to the effect that it would have on women generally, or anyone who would have a child. And it also did not recognize the many, many ways in which the access to abortion care is tied up to so many facet of people's lives. And because women were nearly absent from that decision, the toll it will take on people in this country, on women in particular, on families, I don't think we have yet begun to fully and meaningfully tell that story.
Yeah. Kwajalein, did you want to add to that?
The only thing that I would add additionally is how what we've seen over the past many years is that even in light of the ways abortion has been eroded, there has not been an equal investment in the well-being of people, of families, of children, of mothers. And so when you think about the conditions under which people are making the decision about whether or not they will choose to continue a pregnancy, if they don't have maternity leave, if they don't have consistent affordable childcare, if they don't have access to preventative healthcare for themselves and their families, if they don't have equitable wages, if they don't have stable and secure housing, I could go on and on and on. All of these are conditions that also need to be addressed. They don't eliminate the need for abortion, but they also help families have the ability to thrive and make pregnancy or abortion a real choice rather than an inevitability.
Mm. Now, to be sure and to be clear, the lack of those supports have an impact on many, many Americans, regardless of race. But the impact is particularly profound and painful on families of color, because I keep thinking about what Naisha told us, right? That her husband was already working 12 to 16 hours a day. She was the primary caretaker of their four children. Together, you know, they did everything they could to support their family. But even then, it was hard for them, nearly impossible for them, to find external support if she had to be in the hospital for months and months and months during the duration of that pregnancy. So, Kwajalein, the lack of those supports, is that particularly something that sets back families of color?
Absolutely. We understand that generations of oppression and systemic racism compounded over time, reflected in policy, are a part of what has created the situation that many Black families and families of color find themselves in. We know that the gender pay gap is even more acute for Black women in the workforce. We know that educational opportunities continue to be limited. There are all of these factors, the surveillance and policing of Black neighborhoods that sometimes make people question whether or not they want to bring a Black child into the world where they will be potentially harmed by the state. All of these things are going through the minds and hearts of people when they're thinking about what they want for their futures. So as reproductive justice advocates, we want to make sure that abortion remains accessible for anyone who needs it. And we want people to have the ability to thrive in safe and healthy communities.
Fatima, you know, Kwajalein is directly referencing history here, but so did Justice Alito in the majority's opinion in Dobbs. He spent pages and pages talking about Western history, and then more specifically American history, saying that there was no deeply historical rooted right to abortion in this country. What's your view on how he read that history?
You know, his effort to cherry pick the history and his opinion has been really refuted by historians, and I've been glad to see that. I've been glad to see people like Professor Michelle Goodwin remind the history of slavery and the forced sexual coercion and the forced birth and the prevention of parenting. That was all a feature of slavery undone by the 13th Amendment, right? And so he makes no mention about the country's decision to determine that forced pregnancy and forced birth aren't a part of our Constitution. And he also makes no mention that at the time in the mid-19th century where he is heralding the time we should go back to, that was a time when women couldn't have their own credit, women couldn't vote, women couldn't participate equally in our economy or politics or society. We have rejected that as a nation again and again in and out of our Constitution. So the fact that he is reviving that as our standard is frightening for many of us. Mm.
So let's explore this a little bit further, because as you note, Justice Alito spends quite a bit of time, first of all, refuting the previous justices' assertion that sort of a penumbra right to privacy and therefore abortion can be found in the Constitution. He spends a lot of time talking about how the 14th Amendment and equal protection just doesn't apply here. But to your point, Fatima, the 13th Amendment, which is not mentioned a single time, I reread the whole decision just today. To remind folks, the 13th Amendment says neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction. So, Kwajalein, let me turn to you. That language of involuntary servitude, are you and Fatima saying here that women who can't access abortion services are being subject to a form of involuntary servitude, particularly Black women?
What I believe is that a person who can become pregnant should be the only person who makes a decision about whether they remain pregnant, and that a person's body cannot be used against their will to incubate. That is, in my opinion, deeply unethical. And that the justices continue to ignore the bodily sovereignty that we hold dear as a part of our human rights, our ability to make choices about our health, our well-being, our ability to self-determine, all of those things, to me, feel antithetical to our rights to liberty and the pursuit of happiness. Those things, I don't know that I can liken them directly to servitude, but they do feel deeply inhumane.
Fatima, did you want to give us your take on that?
Yeah, I just think that we as a country, there was a whole civil war, and in the aftermath, that you had the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments that were establishing these new baselines of who we are as a country, baselines around equality in the 14th Amendment and liberty, baselines around not having servitude in the 13th Amendment, and baselines around voting in the 15th. And when I think about those together and I put them side by side with Justice Alito's opinion, he distorts them all. He distorts the idea of what it means to be an equal citizen of this nation. He distorts the idea of whose body and whose life and whose future actually matters. And I will always have in my mind and my heart the date of June 24th, 2022, as the day that he undid it and did something so wrong. It was wrong that day. It's wrong today. And we will continue to work to right that wrong.
You know, there's another layer here that that demands exploration. And that is the, you know, what we know today about maternal health for Black women. You know, I'm seeing data here that says that Black women are three times as likely to die by carrying a pregnancy to term than white women. In Mississippi, where the Dobbs case emerged from, a Black woman is 118 times as likely to die by carrying a pregnancy that's dangerous to her health than by having an abortion. And according to the Mississippi Maternal Mortality Report, in just 3 years, Black women accounted for nearly 80% of pregnancy-related cardiac deaths in that state. So, Kwajalein, let me return back to you, because you're doing all this work at the Feminist Women's Health Center in Atlanta. How does the picture of maternal health, maternal care, maternal mortality for Black women play into this?
Well, we certainly heard in the story that was shared that when Naisha was in labor, about her pain not being believed, about her concerns and cries being dismissed. And that certainly is the case for many Black women and Black birthing people when they enter into the healthcare system. They are met with suspicion. They are met with paternalism. They are talked over, their birth plans are ignored. All of those things are rooted in systemic racism and bias and cause real violence. At the same time, we've also seen the ways that social determinants of health that help to contribute to healthy pregnancy outcomes also be underinvested in across the country. And so we know that abortion is not necessarily a solution to maternal mortality, because again, it is not a choice to decide whether or not I will have a baby and die or terminate a pregnancy. That's not a fair choice to put someone in. So I think we have to work on both ends to make sure that abortion is an option and is available to people when they need it, for whatever reason they need it. Mm-hmm. And we absolutely need to be changing the conditions under which people give birth in this country.
Yeah.
Investing in the ways that people ancestrally have been caring for pregnancies in our communities for a very long time, and really reckon with the ways that our health systems have let people down.
So we've got about a minute, Fatima, before our next break here. That is the point, right? To not look at whether, you know, abortion, yes or no, but to understand more deeply that for women who can't access an abortion, if they're Black, because of the extant problems of lack of access to quality care and the way they've been treated by the healthcare system, they're just in more, they are the numbers seem to be pretty plain, in more danger.
That's right. The numbers have borne out the many failures in our existing healthcare system, from insurance coverage to the quality of care to the availability of care and more. And we will see it only get worse.
Well, this hour, we're really talking about what the overturning of Roe v. Wade means for women of color, for families of color, for women who are already mothers, as those groups form the majority of people who need and seek abortion care in this country. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a specific look at the impact of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and that specific impact on women and families of color. And we're getting a lot of comments here. Marguerite Lachat says on Facebook that the ruling is designed to hurt, confine, control women, especially poor women and Black and brown women. Marguerite says, quote, the Ivankas of the world will get their abortions regardless of laws. Glenn Koenig said it's not just women, it's also men, children, and whole families and even communities that are being impacted. And Gail Bereka says no one is talking about what is to become of the tens of thousands of newborns that will be born to women who cannot care for them. There are no more adoption facilities, no more foster families willing to step up. Gail says the country is not prepared to take care of all these, of all the newborns. I'm joined today by Kwajalein Jackson. She's executive director at the Feminist Women's Health Center in Atlanta and serves on the board of directors of the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. She's with us from Atlanta. Fatima Goss Graves joins us from Washington. She's president and CEO of the National Women's Law Center and co-founder of the Time's Up Legal Defense Fund. Now I'd like to bring in for a moment Janae Nelson. She's with us from Washington as well. She's president and director counsel of the Legal Defense Fund. Janae Nelson, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, can you tell me what your take is, your view of the particular impact that the Dobbs decision will have on women and families of color?
I believe the Dobbs decision is one of the decisions in the pantheon of infamous decisions from the Supreme Court on the same level as a case like Plessy versus Ferguson or the sterilization cases, the ways in which the court has manipulated the Constitution for a particular outcome. And I believe this case is no different, and it will do grievous harm to women and childbearing persons across this country, and particularly Black and brown and Asian women and even poor women of all races who have insufficient access to healthcare today and who bear the brunt of child rearing and also suffer from grave economic disparities and educational disparities that Roe v. Wade helped to not close or completely mitigate, but certainly improved. And when we look at the statistics of Black women who were able to go and pursue higher education and be employed post-Wade, it is quite stark. And I very much fear the conditions that they will be relegated to following this grievous decision.
So do you see this as more than just an abortion decision? It sounds like you're describing that you see this as a pivotal moment for civil rights in this country.
I do. I think this is evidence that we, unfortunately, are faced with an activist court. One of our three branches of government is suffering a significant crisis of credibility of its own making. And decisions like this one that allegedly supports the sanctity of life and yet does not recognize the actual lived conditions of people living among us in society is extraordinarily hypocritical. And when you pair that with the decision that came down the day before Dobbs, which was regarding a gun safety statute in New York, and the cavalier way in which the justices looked at history and locked us into a time period when women and people of color had virtually no rights as the barometer or the filter for how we view and interpret our rights today, tells you that there is an anachronistic, patriarchal, and frankly, deeply discriminatory way in which the court wants to see our society operate today. And it's one that is outdated. It's not the trajectory that the court has been on. And we should all be deeply alarmed, not only about the very important issue of reproductive rights, but all of the other rights that we hold dear and that define our American democracy.
Mm. But, of course, the majority in Justice Alito's decision essentially said, and also Justice Thomas's concurrence, said that the court has a duty to right past wrongs. And they pointed to other major civil rights moments in this country as examples of moments where the court did the right thing. For they said, in Brown v. Board, the court took the correct step in overturning the separate but equal doctrine that had been operating in that country, in this country, until 1954. So the conservative justices on the court see Dobbs as in actually a completely different point of view, and that you're offering, Janae. Your response to that?
Well, I took particular umbrage at the court citing Brown versus Board of Education as an example on the level of what the court was doing in Dobbs, of the court writing past wrongs. First, Roe was not wrong. Roe, in fact, interpreted substantive due process rights in a way that honored its commitment to life and liberty and privacy, which is embedded in that. What this court did is try to create a false equivalency between ending separate but equal and ending the right to choose, the right that every person who can give birth should be able to hold dear and not question. Instead, this court decided that it would advance the forced birth movement's agenda. And this has been something that has been long in the making. And it's important that we not view this decision and view the actions of this court as separate and somehow immune from the outside influences of the world. I know we all like to think and hope to rely on this court to be above politics and not influenced by movements. But in fact, there's been a concerted effort to seat on the court justices who would deliver this particular outcome. So this was not inevitable. This was quite intentional and due to very specific political machinations that led to the composition of the court that we see today. Dobbs is in no way an equivalent to Brown versus Board of Education. And in fact, it's antithetical to the equal protection principles that Brown stands for. Mm. So this is a very, I think, offensive way of Alito to really denigrate one of the canons of our equal protection jurisprudence, and that is Brown versus Board of Education, which the Legal Defense Fund litigated and won in 1954.
Of course, with Thurgood Marshall at the helm, right? So, but Janae, if I can just ask one more question. the court has essentially turned this, by overturning Roe, turned the question of abortion back to the states. Does the Legal Defense Fund have any plan or view of what it might do down the road regarding abortion access in the country?
Yes, well, we filed an amicus brief in the Dobbs case to really elevate the challenges that Black women in Mississippi face, and we will continue to speak about those issues along, you know, with our colleagues in the field to make sure that those women and people who are most impacted by this are not forgotten and that we are protecting them in any way that we can. But I will point out that by the court suggesting that the states can decide this issue, that they are returning this issue to the states, that is, in effect, an abdication of the court's judicial responsibility. And it's a morally bankrupt one as well. When we think about a case that we're actually celebrating today, the 50th anniversary of Furman versus Georgia, which was the only moratorium on the death penalty that this country ever witnessed, and that was another case by the Legal Defense Fund, we return that issue to the states to deal with discriminatory and arbitrary application of the death penalty. And we know that today the states did not rectify that, that the states that continue to impose the death penalty, which again, we believe violates the sanctity of life, they did not correct that wrong. Mm. We cannot rely on states to guard our fundamental human rights. That is the purview of the federal government and the purview of the Supreme Court, the highest court of the land.
Well, Janae Nelson is president and director counsel of the Legal Defense Fund. She joins us from Washington today. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Kwajalein and Fatima, I appreciate your patience there and listening along with me to Janae. Fatima, just give us your quick thoughts on what Janae said. Do you think that there is room now at all for any kind of national level legal recourse in the wake of Dobbs?
Well, I want to pick up on Janae's last point, which is that the idea that our fundamental rights are simply returned to the states as a solution totally disregards the idea that we are one nation and that we have core fundamental rights protected for every person in this country. And so we all are worried, whether you are working on abortion access or not, about that drive to just sort of say, leave it up to the states. But I do think there will be efforts to try to stop what has happened and try to situate the right and access to abortion through other means. But I also want to be clear that the political project of the right to undo Roe and to end abortion access in this country, that has been one that has been decades long that we are seeing coming to light. And so repositioning ourselves in the Constitution fully and fundamentally, that is not an overnight idea, but it is one that folks dedicated around this country will bring to fruition.
Mm. Kwajalein, in the last few minutes that we have in this show, I'd like to once again bring the focus back to the women who have been seeking abortion care, because again the numbers are pretty clear here. There is evidence that increased access to abortion has a positive economic impact, especially on women of color. And in fact, Nyasha's story, who we heard at the top of the hour, was an example of this. There's been research from the Women's Policy Research Center that said following the 1970s, following Roe, there was a 9.6% increase in Black women's college graduation rate and a 7% increase in Black women's labor market participation rate. And that was three times higher than the corresponding rate for women generally. So that's over a 40-year period. So losing that access then potentially means those women losing the opportunity, the time, the resources to be able to take those steps in their lives like Nyasha did. So what I wonder, Kwajalein, is what are you and staff members at the Feminist Women's Health Center telling patients who come in now about what the future might be, what the center might be able to provide for them? Can you tell me a little bit about what those conversations are like?
Well, fortunately, the law has not yet changed in Georgia. So we are continuing to offer care up to the legal gestational limit while we await a decision from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. But that doesn't mean that Georgians who are seeking abortion and calling our center are not afraid, desperate, and feeling very angry about what's happening. Not to mention the many people, as we talked about earlier in the program, who are traveling from states where abortion has been eradicated. Feminist Women's Health Center is committed to achieving reproductive justice. And so we remain undaunted in light of what's happening. We know that the care that we offer, abortion care, comprehensive reproductive health care, trans health care, all of those things will continue to be necessary for our communities. And so we are in a position where we will adapt and evolve so that we can continue to meet those community needs. I want patients to know that we will be there for them and that we honestly believe that abortion will come around again. I think that Fatima is right, that there are many strategies that folks are using or are contemplating around the country right now, local and federal strategies that we will use to try to restore what has been broken, and that communities are working on deepening and widening the ecosystems that support people who seek abortion. We're in conversations with abortion funds that will help people navigate getting to and paying for their care. We are working collaboratively with maternal health and birth workers so that we can really see these things as deeply connected and intersectional, as a part of a continuum, as opposed to two ends. I want the patients who are coming to Feminist Women's Health Center to feel seen, to feel honored, to feel respected, to feel trusted. I think that the Dobbs decision shows that abortion opponents do not trust the people to make their own decisions for their own lives. Hmm. And we want to make sure that at least for a moment, people feel like they are trusted.
Yeah. You know, I suppose this is true for every single decision that comes out of the Supreme Court, regardless of topic, because it's a legal document looking through case law. But the absence of the actual people who seek abortion and need abortion services seemed particularly in sharp relief in this decision. So that's why I appreciate both of you joining us to talk about the very women and families who have been seeking abortion care over the years. Kwajalein Jackson and Fatima Goss-Graves, thank you so very much. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.